ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 4th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, tap, tap, tap. Australians spend nearly $1 billion a year in card surcharges. Now the RBA is cracking its whip and wants costs cut for consumers. And soccer on ice. Australia's young Matildas forced to play on a field blanketed with heavy snow in the Asian Cup. Is this acceptable at international level?
I have never seen a game of international football played in effectively a foot of snow. It was absolutely bizarre. It was shocking. And it was a little bit infuriating, I gotta say.
Australians are losing nearly $1 billion a year in transaction fees when they pay for goods with their cards instead of using cash. The Reserve Bank says these costs can be cut substantially if its scheme is properly implemented, and the RBA wants 80% of merchants to take up that method by the middle of this year. Samuel Yang and Anna Pikett report.
Could I just get the roast pork banh mi? Yeah.
Like many Australians, Alex prefers card over cash to pay for his lunch. But while tap and go is easy, it can often mean you pay more in surcharges. Like Alex, who has just paid 21 cents in surcharges for a banh mi and a cup of coffee. The IT professional from Melbourne says he's noticed more and more businesses have started surcharging in recent years.
It depends on what I buy. Roughly around $200 a year in surcharges, which is substantial. I have a home loan, so every dollar counts. When you get charged extra fees by the banks, it all adds up and you get less in your pocket.
Most debit cards are dual network, meaning they have a Master or Visa logo on the front and FPOS logo on the back. If you insert or swipe your card, you can choose the cheaper FPOS network, but if you choose to tap and pay, the transaction is automatically sent to the more expensive network and you will get the higher surcharge. Adjunct professor at Swinburne University, Steve Worthington, says this is becoming more frequent.
Merchants, as we call them, people who accept payments, are allowed to surcharge, but it should be no more than the cost of their, what's called their merchant acquirer, their merchant service fee. However, we still see people who don't, and they're actually supposed obliged to tell every customer that there is a surcharge for this product.
Unlike in the UK and the European Union, where card surcharges are banned, retailers in Australia are allowed to recoup their payment costs through surcharging as long as they're not making a profit. Analysis based on data from the Reserve Bank reveals Australians are losing almost $1 billion a year in these fees. Larger businesses like department stores and supermarkets do not surcharge because they can absorb the payment costs. But smaller businesses who pass on the payment costs to consumers say they have been hit hard by high inflation and rising costs. Luke Adistra is the CEO of the Council of Small Businesses Organisations Australia.
Really urging government to not make the cost of doing business any worse. In fact, what they should be looking for sustainable solutions to reduce that cost of doing business.
To help cut card processing costs for businesses, the RBA has introduced an initiative called Least Cost Routing, or LCR, which means terminals in businesses will automatically default to the lowest cost card network to process their debit transaction. But so far, only 64% of businesses' terminals are enabled with LCR, with the RBA labelling take-up as disappointingly slow. Brett Kelly is the Managing Director of Payments Consultancy Payment Services. He says the hold-up lies with the banks because they make less money out of least cost routing.
Simply put, there's no incentive for them, so they all drag their feet until they're made to.
Anna Bly is the CEO of the Australian Banking Association. She says bank fees have been steadily coming down over the past decade and the LCR is readily available.
We've seen a 13% drop in the last year in banks' fees and charges across the board. And I do think that those businesses who want to reduce their fees should introduce least cost routing. It's available, every bank offers it.
RBA Governor Michelle Bullock has threatened to make LCR mandatory if the industry does not meet the target of 80% uptake by the middle of the year. Look, Adistra says the small business sector welcomes the mandate, saying the scheme will benefit both small businesses and consumers.
It's a complete non-brainer in this environment where the cost of doing business is quite high.
Luke Attestra from the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia, ending that report by Samuel Yang and Anna Pikett. If you're like most people with a mobile phone or computer, you're being bombarded most days with scams. Now the corporate regulator is ramping up its fight back, taking 3,500 offline. It sounds like a good start, but will more scam operators simply fill the void? I spoke earlier with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, how much pressure is ASIC under to take down these scam websites?
Well, Rachel, a lot of pressure, and ASIC's now saying it's knocked out 3,500 investment scam websites through the regulator's independent takedown capability, which was launched only back in July last year, under pressure to minimise and prevent consumer harm, removing these scams before they lure unsuspected consumers and take potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars from bank accounts, where these consumers are conned into handing over identity details, where scammers based here and overseas systematically target them with scam calls, scam texts, scam emails, in some cases randomly urging people to move money into supposedly safe bank accounts, usually offshore, and then of course the funds disappear. But here's an example of a call intercepted by Westpac last year, which shows just how convincing these scam calls are.
Now, I do have to advise you for training and quality purposes, the calls are being recorded. Okay. Now, just to confirm with them, have you lost or misplaced your card ending with? So, what we're going to do, we're going to have to cancel this card for you today and send you a new card address. So, I can confirm that we're calling from your fraud prevention team and no payments have actually left your account today. So, I have to send you this 6-to-8-digit cancellation code. Have you received that at all from Westpac?
Wow, that really shows the sophistication there of some of those scam calls. That was one detected last year by Westpac. Peter, what sort of pressure are banks themselves facing to eliminate scam sites and to protect their customers?
Well, Rachel, I should note that Westpac customers smelled a rat and got off the call, but really any unsolicited call trawling for ID details and asking for confirmation codes are the danger signs. That's the time to get off the phone and hang up. But ASIC is ratcheting up the pressure on banks to stop these scammers. And the banks themselves, of course, have a very high exposure and a duty to ensure scams are detected and customers are alerted before they agree to hand over these details. This morning's statement from ASIC says that they are now turning their attention to a broader range of banks and superannuation trustees, given their massive responsibility to protect customers. In the past year, ASIC has secured $60 million in civil penalties, 9 criminal convictions, 83 new investigations have been launched, and 19 civil proceedings are underway. But clearly there's a long way to go.
Peter Ryan there. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. In Gaza, there appears no end to the suffering. The UN Children's Agency says at least 10 babies have died from malnutrition, and more infants will die unless thousands of trucks are allowed into Gaza to deliver aid. Over the weekend, the US dropped food from planes into the war-torn strip, but aid agencies say it's not nearly enough. Nicole Johnston has the latest and a warning. Her story contains some graphic details.
Twin babies lay gently on the ground, killed in the middle of the night along with their father during an Israeli airstrike on their home in Rafah. Rania Abu Anza is the twins' mother. She spent a decade trying to get pregnant, and now her babies are gone.
I gave birth in the middle of my 8th month of pregnancy in the war. The war started on Saturday and I gave birth on Friday. I swear I didn't get enough of them. And now their father has gone. He named the girl after him, he said, so that she could carry my name.
Israel insists it does not deliberately target civilians. In the north of Gaza, there is no law, no police on the streets. The US has stepped up, dropping parachutes with ready meals into the north. Dave Harden is a former US aid mission director to the West Bank and Gaza.
38,000 ready-made meals dropped into southern Gaza equals about half of a truck. And we should be getting in 500 to 1,000 trucks every single day, given the humanitarian deficit that we have right here.
In the north, once home to farms, factories, and Gaza City, organized gangs are looting trucks. Dave Harden again.
Gaza is chaotic, it's uncontrolled, it's unsecured, and so, you know, high altitude airdrops of food, it's very unclear who will end up getting it, who controls it, who takes it. It's not being coordinated on the ground with the UN or other aid agencies. And so likely it's the strongest, the best connected, the best network who are getting the food.
Gaza is in the grip of a food crisis so severe that the UN says 500,000 people are on the edge of starvation. The UN's children's agency, UNICEF, says at least 10 babies have died from malnutrition. And what of the ceasefire talks? A deadline to get a deal done is running out. In the US, Kamala Harris, the vice president, says Israel has a right to defend itself, but she's called for an immediate ceasefire.
Let's get a ceasefire. Let's reunite the hostages with their families. And let's provide immediate relief to the people of Gaza to ensure Israel is secure and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination.
But there is no dignity in a life like this. Sama Hadid from the Norwegian Refugee Council in Jordan puts the blame squarely on Israel.
It's appalling that an entire population is left to starve in Gaza whilst vast amounts of aid trucks sit waiting just a few miles away across the border because the Israeli government has denied entry of aid and restricted aid.
Israel says it's not true. It denies trying to starve civilians. Daniel Hagari is an Israeli military spokesman.
We have coordinated a total of 21 airdrops in northern Gaza in collaboration with France, the UAE, Jordan, Egypt, and the United States. We will continue expanding our humanitarian efforts to the civilians' population in Gaza while we fulfill our goals of freeing our hostages from Hamas and freeing Gaza from Hamas.
Without Hamas and without Israel, there is a security vacuum in the north of Gaza. What is left is anarchy, fear, and chaos.
Nicole Johnston. Southeast Asian leaders are arriving in Melbourne for the ASEAN Special Diplomatic Summit to celebrate 50 years of economic ties with Australia. Leaders of major economies, including Indonesia and Singapore, will be attending, but one leader who's not invited is the head of Myanmar's military junta, who deposed Aung San Suu Kyi in a coup 3 years ago. It's just one of the tricky issues Australia will have to navigate in its efforts to improve ties with the region. Angus Randall reports.
It's the biggest diplomatic gathering in Australia since 2018. 9 Southeast Asian leaders getting FaceTime with Australia's government.
From Australia's point of view, you know, we've got hundreds of millions of people in Southeast Asia.
Deputy Prime Minister Richard Miles says it's a big moment for the nation.
Really, Australia's national security lies not so much on our coastline, but much further to the north. And, you know, the defence of Australia doesn't really mean that much unless we have a stable, a secure a safe Southeast Asia.
Australia is not a member of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, but this week's summit in Melbourne marks 50 years since Australia became the group's first dialogue partner. Nick Bisley is a professor of international relations at La Trobe University. He says despite half a century of official ties, Australia has never fully bought in to Southeast Asia.
You know, we trade and invest more with the developed world than we do with emerging market economies. And the stat that I think always blows people's mind is that Australian investors invest more in New Zealand than they do in all of ASEAN.
The conference will also be defined by who is not attending. China is not an ASEAN member, but every ASEAN nation has its own unique relationship to the superpower. Nick Bisley says Australia's strong links to the United States make it difficult to navigate these relationships.
There's a real cleavage within ASEAN between the countries who are quite comfortable with China, you know, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, most obviously, and countries like Singapore and the Philippines that are really uneasy about the competition and have been quite public in the way in which they've positioned themselves. And Australia, because we have been so full-throated in being not only on America's side, but from the previous government, pointing fingers at China in various ways. And so that definitely complicates our relationship both with individual Southeast Asian countries and with ASEAN as a whole.
Another country creating a challenge for ASEAN is Myanmar. Military chief Min Aung Hlaing deposed and jailed democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi 3 years ago. He's not been invited, but some country officials will attend. Deputy Prime Minister Richard Miles says Myanmar's democratic status will be high on the agenda.
Yeah, we want to see a return to democracy in Myanmar. And, you know, ASEAN is very, very focused on what it can do to bring about a return to democracy in that country.
Australia's Burmese community say the invited Myanmar officials are still controlled by the military junta. This morning, they've been protesting outside the conference centre. Richard Tay Rare is the president of the Karenni Federation of Australia.
You cannot be silenced for, like, what is happening, atrocities, you know, like oppression, forced conscriptions, you know, in our country.
The Karenni people are from the eastern part of Myanmar and have been fighting against the ruling military junta. Richard Tay Rare says if Australia wants to lead in Southeast Asia, it needs to take a stand.
Show the partnership and, like, embrace the Burma issue and, like, let's help us to solve the problems, you know, once for all.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is meeting Malaysian counterpart Anwar Ibrahim today. Most leaders will hold meetings from tomorrow.
Angus Randall. Economists say there's a risk the housing crisis will deepen in coming months as the supply of dwellings slows and more Australians lose work. The latest official data show building approvals fell a further 1% in January after falling 10% in December. At the same time, the latest figures on job opportunities show it's getting harder to find work. Reporter David Taylor has more.
The experts agree many more homes need to be built to ease the housing crisis. But the reality is fewer are being constructed.
Another 1% down is clearly bad news for your housing supply.
That's head of research at property analysis firm CoreLogic, Tim Lawless. The latest data from the Bureau of Statistics show in January, the total number of dwellings approved fell 1%, seasonally adjusted, after a 10% fall in December.
We know there's a lot of focus on getting more homes built across the country. There's quite a strong stretch target from the federal government to deliver 1.2 million dwellings over the next 5 years. But yeah, we're not seeing any sign of that starting to turn around at the earliest stage, which is the dwelling approval stage. So to put it into context, we're seeing dwelling approvals holding at these very low levels for more than a year now. In fact, they've been trending at below average levels since just after the home builder grant expired. Gives you a pretty good idea of what's partly at least driving some of this weakness in the supply side of things, was that significant pull forward of demand we saw through the pandemic and the home builder grant that was available. but also just the ongoing challenges for the sector around delivering stock to the market with any sort of profit margin associated with it has become very difficult after a surge in construction costs.
AMP's Deputy Chief Economist Diana Musina says the lack of supply is concentrated among detached houses as opposed to apartment blocks.
Apartments have been flatlining, so the weakness is coming from the detached housing sector. In some ways, it's not surprising given that we've had 425 basis points worth of interest rate rises, and people have, if you're going to take out a loan, you've taken about a 30% hit to your borrowing capacity. So that's what explains the weakness in the construction sector, I think.
Tim Lawless says he can't see supply ramping up anytime soon, which is not what renters will want to hear, as vacancy rates remain close to record lows.
Well, for renters, clearly more supply is what we need in the rental market. And the longer we see dwelling approvals remaining this low, the longer it's going to take to get more supply into both homes for owner-occupiers, but also homes for investors or for renters. So we're not seeing any sort of supply response in the rental sector at the moment. So it does mean that we're probably going to be seeing this ongoing upwards pressure on rents as vacancy rates remain around record lows across most markets.
To add insult to injury, there's also evidence, says Diana Musina, that finding a job is getting harder as the economy slows.
Employment's going to slow from here, and I think it's in line with the unemployment rate reaching about 4.5% by the middle of this year. If you take in all the leading indicators into account, not just the ANZ job ads, but other ones as well, then it shows a further increase in the unemployment rate.
The latest health check on the economy comes Wednesday with the release of gross domestic product or GDP figures.
David Taylor. While the Matildas enjoyed premium conditions for their sold-out match last week in Melbourne, their junior counterparts have had to weather very different conditions in Uzbekistan. The young Matildas took on South Korea in their first match of the Under-20 Asian Cup and were forced to play in ankle-deep snow. So is this good enough for a game at the international level, and why was it allowed to proceed? Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
The young Matildas weren't just up against a strong South Korean side in Uzbekistan last night. Their boots were hidden by a layer of ankle-deep snow.
The ball holds up to shouts of her name from Captain Jessica Nash. They're trying to clear it out to where there's synthetic.
When it came to a free kick, gloveless South Korean players had to use their bare hands to dig through the icy mush.
Each of them are having to dig out a place for the free kick to restart the game here. It's utterly fascinating.
While some effort had been made to clear the centre circle, sidelines and goals, the remainder of the field was covered in white, leaving many unimpressed. Former Matildas player Shona Bass says it's not good enough.
At an international level, you'd expect that you'd be able to have a surface where the ball would actually travel, you know, seamlessly across the surface. And clearly, a snow-covered pitch, that's not going to be the case. And the other thing is, you know, there were some areas of the pitch that were cleared and other areas of the pitch that's had ankle-deep snow. And so apart from the fact that you couldn't really play a professional standard game, it was also a safety issue for the players.
Samantha Lewis is a football journalist for the ABC.
I have never seen a game of international football played in effectively a foot of snow. It was absolutely bizarre. It was shocking. And it was a little bit infuriating, I got to say. Like, this is a really important competitive match for both Australia and South Korea. This is the first group game of the Under-20s AFC Women's Asian Cup, and it's an important pathway for qualification for the Under-20s Women's World Cup as well.
She says it's unlikely male players would have been subjected to the same conditions.
I doubt that the AFC would allow men's teams to go through something like this, and partly I think that's because I don't think men's teams would allow themselves to be subjected to this kind of treatment. It was incredibly disrespectful of the players, of the coaching staff, of the entire competition, really.
The young Matildas fought back to take the win, which Samantha Lewis put down to a never-say-die attitude.
The fact that they not only had to go out there and endure, like, minus temperatures, but they had to also try and play good football and get a result in this situation. It's just awful. And I really credit the players for persevering and for being so resilient and just dealing with whatever was thrown at them, because I think a lot of us would have just packed up and left.
Heather Reid is a pioneer of the women's game in Australia. She says it poses questions for the Asian Football Confederation.
There is apparently a FIFA rule that says if the ball cannot run freely across the surface of the field, then the pitch is unplayable. And you could see during the game that the ball would just get stuck in the snow, and the players were sort of trudging through, you know, 1 or 2 feet of snow. So it just beggars belief that they didn't clear the entire field when they had plenty of time to do so. It wasn't like there was such heavy snowfall that it would have, formed on the field again once they'd cleared it.
Football Australia has been contacted for comment.
Elizabeth Cramsey with that report. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy. Stay safe. Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. Every so often, a product comes along that takes us by storm and in the process shifts spending and changes economies. The iPhone, Netflix and ChatGPT spring to mind. But less obvious is something like Ozempic. Today, the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder, on how the drug being used for weight loss is breaking down business models. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.